Going.
Would the Sergeant at Arms please grab Commissioner Gregson?
Good. Check him out. Today is Wednesday. Council is back in session. This is our afternoon session. It's just after 2 p.m. on July 29th, 2009. Carla, would you please call the roll?
Saltzman. Leonard. Fritz.
Here.
Fish.
Here.
Adams.
Here. I would like to, unless there are council objections or unless I have to have a council vote, do I have to have a council vote on the continuation? Unless there are council objection, I would like to continue 1060, which is adopt and implement the Hayden Island Plan and amend comprehensive plan map. Continue that to August 12, 2009 at 3 p.m. Without objection, so continued. If it pleases the council, what I'd like to do is the 2 p.m. time certain. I think we will end on time or just a little early for that. We've got a quick housing issue, and that should put us on time for the 2:30. There's a typo, 2:30 p.m. time certain. Or we could wait till the 2:30 a.m. time certain. Hey, it's cool in here. Cooler than my house. So, could you please read the title for the time certain, council calendar item 1075?
Direct Bureau of Transportation to implement the Spokane Bicycle Boulevard and clarify process for implementation of new bicycle boulevards throughout Portland.
So when I took office as mayor, I set as one of my goals for first 100 days in office is to fund 15 miles of bike boulevards, of new bike boulevards. These are low traffic streets that are specifically designed to prioritize bikes and pedestrians for safe bicycling and walking. And clearly, they are also great for neighborhoods. But equally important, they are a great community building opportunity if the planning of them is done in the Portland spirit of community-based grassroots planning. I'm pleased to move forward today for the council consideration the proposal to establish a bike boulevard on Southeast Spokane. It's a prime example of how Bike Boulevard has been embraced by a neighborhood for both its cycling and community benefits. So I'm pleased to bring forward Paul and or Mark, are you coming forward? Who are going to tell us a little bit more about this. Who wants to begin?
I'll start, Mayor Adams. Mark Lear, City of Portland, Bureau of Transportation. I've got just a quick, I think it's 10-slide PowerPoint presentation. This is actually the presentation that we use in neighborhoods when we're talking about bike boulevards. I'll go over it pretty quickly because I know the council has quite a bit of background on this. We start our presentation at each of these group meetings, and we have 8 boulevard projects currently active with Why Bike Boulevards. And first thing that we talk about is just great Portland pride around what a great city we have for walking, biking, and taking transit. We've won lots of awards for that. But the thing that we highlight in this slide is that Portland really is very unique in another way, and that's around our traffic safety accomplishments. Since 1986, as you can see in this Portland traffic fatals, we've reduced the number of fatals from 60, 70, 80 a year to down with last year, the lowest number of traffic fatals. This is for all modes put together, pedestrian, bicycle, and motor vehicle. That year was the lowest on record, not the lowest rate, but the actual lowest number of fatals. What's really significant about this, if you look at the graph right below this, the national trend has been something that's been very different. Even with all the improvements with airbags and in-car safety devices, the number of fatals have stayed flat, and that's true in Oregon as well. But in Portland, we've broken that trend. It's very positive. That said, we still have a lot of hope. Even though we've improved safety, if you look at this chart, what I think a lot of you have probably seen before, which is a survey of why people, who rides and and who's interested in riding. We still have the majority of Portlanders, or 60%, that are interested but concerned. The bike lane on a busy street isn't enough to make them comfortable riding their bike or riding with their family. And what we've heard is that the bike boulevard is something that will attract those types of users. So the main things that we're looking at with our bike boulevards is keeping speed low, trying to keep volumes at an acceptable level, and then the crossing of the busy streets ends up being one of the challenges. And again, we're designing this system for the most vulnerable users, the families, the seniors. I mean, it's really interesting that both children and seniors have similar sort of challenges. You know, determining the speed of an oncoming vehicle ends up being a big challenge. But if you look at the map right here, which is a blow-up of Paul's neighborhood, you can see that all we really have in this neighborhood right now is an awesome trail system, which has some missing links still in it, as well as bike lanes on busy streets. And what they were calling for, and they came to us when we were working on the Safe Sound and Green Street effort, was wanted a bike boulevard on Spokane. With bike boulevards, we focus on five goals: safety, comfort, attractiveness, direct routes, and connected system. And the connected system is both the connection of bike lanes to bike boulevards, but also the connection to transit routes and to businesses, parks, and schools. Our bike boulevard goals are very specific. Three things. We want to keep speeds under 25 miles an hour. We want to keep volumes less than 1,000 wherever possible. And we want to make those crossing improvements safe and frequent. So on this map, you can see that piece of Spokane that makes this nice connection from our trail network up through the neighborhood, paralleling Tacoma. Another major goal of our bike boulevards is to be very near or paralleling those busy streets that have our shops and businesses. For speed and traffic management, two of those goals, the main tools that we work on for reducing speed are speed bumps, islands, chicanes, a series of speed bumps that would actually slow drivers as they turn down a street, and then other kind of green street treatments. You can see this example at 17th and Shaver, which we would refer to as a semi-diverter, is an example of the kind of treatment that we would use to manage volumes. This slide shows the crossing improvements, and for the most part on these projects that we're talking about, it's things like the curb extension that you can see at Southeast 12th and Clay, where we bring the bicyclist out farther into the street, improving visibility and the pedestrian, and also increasing the visibility. And then the slide that's a little hard to read in the left-hand corner, that Southeast Sandy and Ankeny, is an example of a pedestrian island. Pedestrian islands are very effective, reduce crashes at these kind of intersections by over 40%. They allow pedestrians and bicyclists to sort of make their own safe way across by taking a two-phase crossing of a street. And then something that we would like to do more of but currently don't have the funding for is do more of like hawk signals like you see at East Burnside and 41st. A lot of our boulevards would benefit from this type of improvement, but without additional funding, federal funding or something like that, those aren't included in this current round.
And a hawk signal is where the user presses the button to get the light to change.
Exactly. I mean, the simplest way, I think, to describe a hawk signal, unless somebody doesn't understand it, it's sort of like a railroad crossing. When the bicyclist pushes that button or there's a detector that picks up the cyclist, those lights flash like you'd expect at a railroad crossing, and so it stops traffic, and it allows that infrequent red light to still be very effective and not have high levels of noncompliance that could be very dangerous to bicyclists and pedestrians. I won't go into this in great detail because the council probably knows this, but we value planning as part of our boulevard projects, as part of our bike planning generally. This is the process that we've been using in our bike boulevard meetings, and we're proposing with this resolution to do for the rest of the projects. We identify all the residents on the project street, generally 100 feet off of the project street. We notify district coalitions and neighborhood associations and any other interest groups that we're aware of that are interested in the project in that project area. And then we have open houses where we review existing conditions. That means speeds, volumes, crash histories. And then we start to look at specific improvements and begin that discussion with neighborhoods. Then we come back for a second open house where we bring out some proposal or solutions with a goal of reaching a level of consensus that we're comfortable in bringing that back to the transportation director. In some cases, we'll definitely need more than a second open house, but in general, this has worked pretty well, and I'll let Paul describe that in just a second. So this is the design, which I'll highlight just briefly, of what we're proposing for Spokane Boulevard. There's the three major goals that I talked about before: crossing safety for pedestrians and cyclists, 13th and 17th, those two busiest streets. In one location at 13th, we're proposing a swale treatment
along with a pedestrian island that allows pass-throughs for bicycles and pedestrians. We're also working with fire on this to make sure that it's a design that works well for emergency response. At 17th, and I think this is a good example of how we listened to businesses and tried to be responsive, is we decided, based on our performance goals and some pushback from some of those neighboring businesses, to take away the hard median that was between those two pedestrian islands, and instead, near the community center, near 15th, we did a speed bump very close to a crosswalk, similar to a raised crosswalk, and then we did a pinch point type treatment that has medians that protect the cyclist from being squeezed by cars that are coming through that pinch point. We also used that same treatment at 6th, where we used a pinch point, and partially we wanted to be responsive, and the neighborhood really wanted us to do this, to be responsive to those peak flows that come out of Sellwood, especially in the summertime. In addition to that, we're flipping. There were 5 stop signs in this corridor before this project. I think we've taken that down to 2 stop signs. So we have stop signs, of course, where we have the busy streets. But again, the cyclists that are using this corridor, we want it to be as convenient and as fast as possible. So we've taken out those stop signs where they're not necessary and done that by using speed bumps to still control speed. So with that overview, I will turn it over to Paul Noddy.
Thank you, Mark. Mayor Adams and members of City Council, my name is Paul Noddy, President of the Sellwood-Moreland Improvement League. For the last year and a half, our neighborhood organization has worked together with PDOT on the Southeast Spokane Street Bike Boulevard project, listening to neighborhood safety issues, crafting a proposed bike boulevard design, holding public meetings, several, considering neighborhood community center, parks, schools, and business interests, and finalizing a bike boulevard design for Southeast Spokane Street, which meets the following goals for our neighborhood: create a safe route for bikes and pedestrians traveling throughout Sellwood, promote neighborhood livability by reducing cut-through traffic to the Sellwood Bridge, foster a more business-friendly neighborhood with increased ped and bike access to our business district. The support for this project has been substantial. Initially, the SMILE, that's Sellwood-Moreland Improvement League, membership in the spring of 2008 voted unanimously to endorse the Safe, Sound, and Green Streets initiatives for Southeast Spokane Street. We met with several businesses affected, including those on 13th Avenue and 17th. The response was very positive. On May 3rd at our general meeting, a standing room only crowd listened to PDOT's proposal and then moved to endorse the plan by a 59-5 margin, providing a ringing endorsement for the neighborhood. Several additional supporters were not there due to scheduling conflicts. These next-generation bike boulevards offer a tremendous opportunity to improve livability in Portland, and the cost justifies it. We expect more bike traffic and more families and more kids biking to school to Westmoreland or Sellwood Park, more couples biking to Bertie Lou's for breakfast on a late Saturday morning or going for coffee on 13th Avenue. This project helps glue the community together, and it increases its attractiveness as a destination for visitors. Safety is essential to livability. The City of Portland is a national leader in pushing for neighborhoods that are self-sustaining, reducing the need to drive for basic amenities. It is difficult to have a livable neighborhood when crossing streets to buy a loaf of bread risks bodily injury to vehicles from vehicles. This project will make it safer to cross 13th and 17th Avenue. Another key element of this proposal is a special business district speed reduction to 20 miles per hour on 13th and 17th Avenue. Our neighborhood has met with businesses up and down these corridors, as well as the Sellwood-Westmoreland Business Alliance. We currently are collecting petitions in support of the 20-mile-an-hour zone. Reducing the speed will help business and the community. Our Transportation Committee recommends modification of the speed limit, starting at Southeast Lynn, going as far north as we meet the requirement for Business District, which is Nehalem on 17th, and could extend all the way up 13th through Westmoreland as it turns into Bybee. The 13th Avenue Business District connects to Bybee Boulevard, hosts dozens of businesses, and the farmers market. Lower speeds will help the businesses and neighborhood alike. Already, SWBA is pushing for traffic reduction in several areas, as well as crosswalks. The project also considers the traffic issues in our neighborhood and for our businesses. It will still allow a solid path in and out of Oaks Bottom for Oaks Bottom Amusement Park, the pool, and the parks. It will integrate nicely with Alternative D for the new Sellwood Bridge, and it will allow efficient access to the community center, our churches, our schools, and our businesses on 13th and 17th Avenue. PDOT and the neighborhood took great care not to shift the traffic problem. Instead of hard diversions, for example, most of the treatments are soft, meaning they don't push traffic onto neighborhood streets. They also maintain convenient access in and out of the neighborhood. I'd like to thank the residents and their business of Selwood Westmoreland for their support. Few of them are here today, as well as the City of Portland's Bureau of Transportation for their tireless effort to create this exciting project. And to you, our city leaders, in your commitment to developing safe bicycle access throughout our wonderful city, I urge you to vote in support of the Southeast Spokane Bike Boulevard.
And I just want to underscore, Paul, because of your leadership of this neighborhood, I mean, this is first implementation of the 15 miles of bike boulevards. It's not an easy neighborhood, a lot of mixed use, a lot of visitors to the neighborhood on a regular basis. We could have chosen maybe an easier neighborhood for the first sort of implementation of these 15 miles, but we chose this neighborhood because of, in part, your leadership, and I want to thank you for that.
Thank you.
We have a few people signed up to testify, is that right?
We have six people.
All righty. Three at a time. Please come forward.
First three are Stan Scotton, Steve Zagethi, and Margot Menison.
Good afternoon. We're glad you're here. Why don't you begin, sir?
My name is Stan Scotton. I live at 635 Southeast Spokane Street. That's on the northwest corner of that intersection. That is in location to one of the pinch points we're going to have. I think Mark was off by a street when he said 6th. I think it's still going in on 7th. And then there's the we're getting a new speed bump on Spokane between 6th and 7th. I'm here in support of both the bicycle and the pedestrian improvements. And particularly, I'm here in support of the process that we went through. I thought that was very well handled. I was really pleased with the transportation folks, Mark and his group, and the engineers. Environmental Services had a woman there whose name I don't remember, I'm sorry. And I also want to commend the SMILE Board, the Southern Water Improvement League. I think Phil may testify, and he's the one that got me involved. And they're to be commended. They're to be commended.
Thank you, sir, very much. Appreciate it. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Mayor and members of council. My name is Steve Zagethi. I live at 1015 Southeast Spokane. And I'm here to voice my strong support for the project as someone who lives on the street and uses a bicycle for commuting to work and running neighborhood errands, at least when it's below 100 degrees. I'm clearly a beneficiary of this project, but it's not just about me and the other estimated 1,800 bicycle trips that occur on my street each day. It's also about pedestrian safety and automobile safety and neighborhood quality of life. By providing the semi-diverters, median barriers, and pinch points at three key locations, the project will greatly reduce the well-documented problem of cut-through traffic to the Selwood Bridge and Oaks Park. These automobile diversion features send a message that Spokane Street is a neighborhood street for safe walking and bicycling, and that Selwood is a place where people live, work, shop, recreate, and not a pass-through neighborhood where the goal is to find the path of least resistance to the bridge. Turning the stop signs to facilitate bike travel is another very helpful feature, one of many small gestures that add up to making bicycling an attractive option for getting around the city. And all the while, I think the impact on residential and business parking is very minimal, with most of the homes already having driveways, most of the street having parallel parking, and the availability of several off-street parking lots. So I could go on about the other merits of the project, the green features, the lowering of the speed limits that Paul was talking about, but I'll just stop here and say that I look forward with excitement to the construction and completion of the project, and I look forward to seeing more bicyclists pass by my house and to personally using the bike boulevard to safely get where I need to go, at least when the temperatures drop below 100. So thank you, members of council.
Thank you for your testimony. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor and council members. My name is Margot Menison, and I'm speaking on behalf of Scott Bricker, the executive director of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. The BTA is delighted to see the Bureau of Transportation moving forward with so quickly to build 15 miles of new bicycle boulevards, and we fully support the implementation of Southeast Spokane bike boulevard treatments. As we've heard, people are really excited to see real on-the-ground bike improvements coming to their neighborhoods. And city staff and Mark Lear and his staff have done a great job of involving the neighbors and the businesses, just to ensure that each design meets the needs unique to that neighborhood. And the BTA has worked with the city to encourage cyclists and our members to get out there and attend the meetings and speak up and engage with their neighbors. And we're really looking forward to continuing to work with the city and build more bicycle boulevards and keep getting people to ask for more. So we also appreciate the council's leadership in passing a budget for this year that included funding for bike boulevard projects. And we look forward to supporting the city as it makes good use of those valuable funds. Thank you.
Thank you all very much for your testimony. Carla, the next three
are Philip Crane, Erica Jayasuriya, and Barry Joe Stoll.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the City Council. We're glad you're here.
Good
You just only need to give us your first and last name, and that clock will help you count down 3 minutes. Who would like to go first?
I guess I'll go first since I was first on the list. Good afternoon, Council, Mayor Adams. My name is Philip Crane. I'm a former board member of SMILE on the Transportation Committee, as well as a former board member of Southeast Uplift. Been working on this project for a good year and a half or whatnot, and all I can say is that it is wonderful to see this all come to fruition. I will repeat briefly what everybody has been saying, that PDOT has done a fantastic job. Mark, Greg, and then BES with Ivy Dunlop have really been there in support, have really done everything that they can do to make this really a collaborative process. I actually live on 7th and Spokane Street. I'm going to have basically a direct impact or hit to parking right in my right by my house as a result of the pinch point. Having said that, I'm happy to do it because, you know, this is just going to be such a wonderful project for the street. And like the previous gentleman, I see bikes and runners and of all ages going up and down Spokane Street constantly. And to really have a safe passageway is really important. And I think having lived a year in Copenhagen, and I've basically been a bike commuter for 13-plus years all year round, to have more bikes being able to integrate within the population, within the city, it's good for business, it's good for neighborhoods, it's good for families, and it's a really special thing. Let's see. One other thing I wanted to say, there's quite a few, but I didn't prepare anything. We do have just a social event called Green Drinks that you probably heard downtown. We have one over in Selwood, and started that, and we meet at the Muddy Rudder, which is on the corner of 7th and Tacoma, first Wednesdays of the month. So I just want to formally invite you all to come down and be happy to.
What time?
The Muddy what?
6 o'clock. 6 o'clock in the after work. The Muddy Rudder. The Muddy Rudder. It's actually named after Alaskan Chinook salmon as they're going upstream. The gentleman that put this place together did a fantastic job. Everything is sustainable. He did a tremendous amount of work to this place personally. And again, like to make that invitation out to you. It's where I also started the Sustainability Committee for the Neighborhood Association. I'm still the current chair. We have a lot of initiatives going on, and this is just basically a place where people that are interested in these type of topics meet and just hang out. So thank you again.
Thank you very much for your work on this project. We really appreciate it, sir.
Hello, my name is Barry Joe Stull. It's a two-name name, Barry Joe. I'm going to spell it to you for a reason that I think is kind of pertinent. It's Barry, middle name Joe, last name Stull. Now, if anybody types that into a search engine, probably the first thing that's going to come up is when I was a candidate for the Pacific Green Party the year 2000. That's almost 10 years ago. And one of the issues that I focused my campaign on was the need to reduce the deaths to cyclists so that people would be able to ride bicycles. That, however, didn't stop me from being a victim in a car-on-bike crash where a gentleman ran the stop sign. And lucky for me, I wasn't in the fatalities because I have a good eye for danger. Danger's my business, and I have to be prepared. I'm glad that the city is finally catching up to these ideas that have been around for a while. I recall having a conversation just this past year with our now dearly departed Bud Clark, and recalling him whooping as we passed each other on the Broadway Bridge about 15 or more years ago on my when I was going to Portland Community College. And the question I had to ask him was, could you imagine when we were doing that, that there would be the 10,000 or so bicyclists that are coming daily into downtown Portland? A lot of this is ideas that have been out there, and it's taken a while for it to come through, and it's basically because there are a lot of moneyed interests that are opposed to these things. Now, I have a spinal cord injury, and I have difficulty here with the city of Portland, particularly the Portland police, because I'm protected under the Medical Marijuana Act. Now, during our recess here, I didn't have a chance to go medicate, but I did have a chance to go on a hard bike ride. I made it up to the top of the Broadway Bridge, and I came back, and I rode hard up Broadway because that generates endorphins, and I hope to appear to be the most healthy-looking 50-year-old person with a disability that you're likely to encounter, and that's because bicycling has a multitude of benefits, and I'm just so heartened that although I signed up to testify on other matters today, that this is on the agenda. Thank you for supporting it.
Thank you, Mr. Stoll. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Erica Jayasuriya, and I live at 1323 Southeast Spokane. I've been in the Selwood neighborhood for 19 years, and I was just telling my neighbor that this is the first July that I have not had to call 911 for somebody having an accident in front of my house, because the corner of 13th and Spokane, especially once Oaks Park opens up, has every single year brought an accident to my front yard. Sometimes literally in my front yard, as cars have skidded and ended up in my garden. And more likely that the cars collide at that particular point, often because as cars are coming up from Oaks Park and they suddenly discover that they have to turn right, I sit there and we watch, my children and I watch, as a little psychology exam where we look at the people, and you can tell who knows that they're about to do something illegal. So they then really, you know, jump the intersection as fast as they can. And where the current speed bump is, it's still far enough down the street that they're able to do this. So while I am more of a pedestrian than I am a bicyclist, I am in full support of this project. I have been really impressed with the way, especially in comparison to participating over the years with the Tacoma Street Plan and the Selwood Bridge, that to see this so well organized, so well communicated to the neighbors involved in the process, and to see it actually, you know, in a pretty expedient way come to some fruition has been very exciting and very heartening. And no one yet has talked about this, so I'm going to just say briefly that more than the bicyclists, because to be honest, from my vantage point, most of the bicyclists that use the Spokane Street tend to be older. And I have a 13-year-old, and I've raised him in this neighborhood, in this house, and I have never allowed him to ride his bicycle on our street. It is so dangerous, our street, for young people, and to be the block with the Selwood Community Center on it, to have to tell his friends when they're visiting, you know, from other parts of the neighborhood, do not bike on Spokane Street. If I catch you biking on Spokane Street, you know, I will not be happy with it. So in gratitude for the safety of our children, which there are so many in our neighborhood, I really encourage you to do everything to get this so that it continues this nice expedient process and we can have a safe neighborhood for everyone concerned.
Thank you very much. Thank all of you for your testimony. All right, unless there's additional...
One more.
Oh.
Barbara Barber.
Ms. Barber, no problem. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi.
My name's Barbara Barber, and I live at 1202 Southeast Spokane. My home is located two doors up from 13th Street, and I note this because I have a perfect view of the confluence of bicycles and automobiles at that intersection. it can be kind of a busy, complicated intersection. And it's made worse by the use of Spokane Street as a cut-through by commuter traffic. Bicycles coming off of the East Side Esplanade and the Springwater Trail move through the Selwood neighborhood, and they utilize Spokane to access Selwood, to continue on to the next leg of the Springwater Corridor, or to cut north to Westmoreland, Eastmoreland, and Reed College. I ask you to approve the Spokane Street Boulevard, the Spokane Street Bike Boulevard. Over the years, it has enjoyed that status on an unofficial level. I actually found this morning. It's a 1991 Metro map, and it has streets for bicycles listed here, and Spokane's one of them. And it sort of made me laugh because it said it's a low traffic street that has traffic moving at slow speeds. And maybe in 1991, that was a fact.
I don't think so.
But somewhere along the line, it became a little more complicated. So what I'm asking is for you to elevate it and give it the basic infrastructure to function as a real bike boulevard. It would not only serve the bicycle community in terms of access, it would provide a real component of safety to our neighborhood. And lastly, and then I will be done, I'm presenting, I know that sometimes a question comes up regarding businesses and lowering of speed limits, but I ran around like a complete nut in this heat for the last couple days. And in no time at all, I managed to get 39 business signatures.
Wow.
In support of the lowering of the speed limit on 13th Street, a few from 17th Street, but that's only because I didn't have the time to hit them too. I must tell you that people readily signed on to the idea of turning 13th and 17th into a business district and lowering the speed limit. I only found a couple sort of recalcitrant types that considered it a bit of a chip off the old freedom block. But for the most part...
For the most part,
people are pretty happy at the notion of traffic slowing down. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your consideration.
Thanks for being such a great advocate, Ms. Barber. All right, Carla, would you please call the roll?
Leonard?
Well, I am a user of bike boulevards and one in close proximity to this area, and appreciate them. I actually had the opportunity to go out with one of Sam's employees, Greg Raisman, who invited me to go one morning 2 years ago as he actually plotted out a bike boulevard across Foster. Did you go with us? That was a very cold morning, but it was a lot of fun, and I enjoyed it and appreciate the amenities that they are that one wouldn't necessarily recognize unless you were actually there using them and particularly watching them being designed. So I'm very happy to support this. Bye.
Fritz.
Well, I want to thank the staff for good work. Mark Lear was especially helpful answering our questions, particularly on funding, and people may be interested to know that it's a combination of funding with affordable transportation funds, Environmental Services Green Streets Fund from the Environmental Protection Agency, Portland Development Commission, TriMet, Portland Bureau of Transportation in their Missing Link funding, and also federal stimulus funds. So it's a complete package of different entities all recognizing that indeed bike boulevards are very important for all of the reasons that you have stated for the neighborhood livability as well as for transportation and enjoyment. I want to thank Amanda Mansfield on my staff, who's my liaison to the Bicycle Advisory Committee, and Carrie Turcon, who helped with this report. Aye.
Fish.
Well, thank you for an excellent presentation. Thanks to the citizens who came out on a hot day to testify. Sam, thanks for your leadership on this issue. Mm-hmm. And I wrote down Muddy Waters, but that's not right.
Muddy Rudder.
Thank you. And
sorry about that. I need to articulate better.
Muddy Waters is in the tavern.
Yeah.
Right next there. The
drinks are based on Willamette
jukebox.
River water.
Commissioner Leonard and I might have to do a field trip to inspect this.
Yeah, I think so, too.
There might be some code issues we might want
exactly.
to look at. Anyway, great job, and thank you very much. I vote aye.
Adams.
Well, first, reiterate my thanks to the Neighborhood Association, leadership of the Neighborhood Association at various different levels for working so quickly and just so diligently to get this done. I want to thank Mark Lear, Kyle Chizik, Abby Dunlop for their great work in getting this done, and Catherine Charlo on my staff for helping to shepherd this. We get to save lives, we get to improve neighborhoods, and for our local neighborhood businesses, get them more money, more customers. Great project. Thank you. Aye. So approved. Can you please read the title for Time Certain 1076, and then we will do Commissioner Fish's item after that.
Native American Youth and Family Center presentation.
Commissioner Fritz.
Sorry. I've invited representatives from the Native American Youth and Family Center to tell the council about the issues they're confronting, the programs they offer, and the successes that this organization has brought to the city of Portland and its urban Native community. Approximately 40,000 American Indians and Alaskan Natives reside in the Portland metropolitan area. This is the ninth largest Native American community in the United States. This population is comprised of peoples indigenous to the Portland metro area, the Pacific Northwest, and those from other parts of America. The stories that brought Native peoples to this urban area are as diverse and unique as each of the more than 500 tribal nations whose ancestry is rooted in this continent since time immemorial. The Native American Youth and Family Center dedicates itself to the enrichment of Native peoples' lives with a focus on cultural identity and education. This organization has evolved and broadened its scope of work ever since its informal inception as the Native American Youth Association in 1974. The promotion of traditional cultural values in conjunction with a healthy and active lifestyle is the core of these key values. And, of course, they're one of our valued partners in the Office of Neighborhood Involvement with a Diverse Community Leadership Program. And so I invited some of the leadership. And today we have Nicole Maher, who's the Executive Director, and Lois Chilcott, who's one of the elders. And they'll be followed by Cerise Palmatier and Christine Dupre. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mayor Adams and City Commissioners.
Good afternoon.
It's good to be here. Thank you for the invitation to share some of the good work that is happening at NAIA. But first, I must properly introduce myself and tell you who I really am. I am Shante Washdewin, Happy Heart Woman, an enrolled member of the Menominee Tribe of Wisconsin. My Christian name is Lois Chilcott. I can't even fudge on my age a little bit. Suffice it to say that I am an elder. I'm one of the 38,000 Native Americans who call Portland home. This is my home. I've lived here for over 30 years. I retired in 1990, and since then, I've been very active in the Native American community and also in the Portland communities also. I'm on the board of directors of NAIA, and I serve on Elders in Action Commission, and I volunteer at quite a few places. I really have a busy life because I do enjoy people and volunteering. Before I talk about NAIA, I want to talk about the Native American citizens that you represent and take some time to tell you about making the invisible visible. Commissioner Amanda did read some of the statistics about the Portland community, but I'm going to go ahead and read them also. Portland has the ninth largest Native American community in the United States. We live here, we thrive here, and we are numerous. The Portland urban community is descended from over 350 tribes and has many of us have multi-tribal and multi-ethnic backgrounds. We represent various degrees of tribal affiliations. Some of us are tribally enrolled and some are not. But all of us have ties to our ancestral homes. Some of us are enrolled members of local tribes, like the Umatilla and the Yakima and the Nez Perce, who have retained some of their fishing rights on the Columbia and Willamette Rivers. We come to the city for as many reasons as there are clans and people, and our stories are powerful. The Portland metro area rests on traditional village sites of the Multnomah, Kathlamish, Clackamas, can you say these? Chinook, Tualatin, Kalapuya, Mulala, and many other tribes who made their homes along the Columbia River and they've lived here and created communities and summer gathering encampments since time immemorial. After European contact, what followed for the indigenous people of the United States was a series of territorial and then federal policy decisions designed to eliminate and later assimilate Native people. I think we all know about, we're all aware of that, you know, to more or less degrees. The 18th and 19th centuries brought disease that disseminated populations among us, sometimes 9 out of 10. The boarding school era, which lasted from the 1800s to the 1960s, marked the beginning of a long campaign to integrate indigenous, I can hardly say that, people into the Western culture. Kill the Indian, save the man, summarized the philosophy that underlay most government policies of that era. Federal relocation policies, which began in the 1950s, forced over a third of Native populations to relocate to 7 major cities, including Portland. Termination of federal recognition of many tribes began in 1954 under the Western Oregon Termination Act and the Klamath Termination Act. A large number of Oregon tribes had their governments abolished, lands taken, and their governments abolished and lands taken and social services. I lost my spot there. In 1977, the Confederate Tribes of Siletz would be the first Oregon tribe to regain its federally recognized status. Later on, the Grand Ronde and Klamath have subsequently, you know, had their sovereignty restored. There are still tribes in Oregon for whom termination remains a bitter reality, and even for tribes who have been reinstated, its effects still are felt, because in some cases, like the Klamath, you know, you can't restore the forest to them. The trees are gone. You know, their land and the assets where they're gone. They can't come back. In the year 2000, the census in the metropolitan area, which includes Multnomah County, said that we were 19,209 Native Americans of one race and 38,926 multiracial Native Americans living in the Portland area. Currently, Native people count disproportionately, let me have a drink of water here. It's a big word. Native people count disproportionately among the urban poor. We experience the highest rate of homelessness, poverty, and unemployment of all ethnic groups. Depression, addiction, and diabetes impact us in numbers far exceeding the norm. We constitute 24% of all children in foster homes in the state of Oregon, and only 37% of our children in school graduate from high school at graduation time. Even with our large population and the strong evidence of need, resources have not been equitably distributed to us. There are false perceptions in the community that we no longer exist. You know, some people can say, I didn't know you were still here. But anyhow, these stereotypes have made it difficult for us to gain the kind of funding and things that we need for our programs. It is commonly believed that our education and our health care and our social services support system are fully paid for by the federal government and by casino earnings. Well, that's about, you know, that's not true at all. Some of us don't even have a casino, and others don't even have a tribe. These misunderstandings lead to policies and decisions that limit our access to social services and other community resources in the city. Despite these barriers, we continue to foster our culture and celebrate our heritage. We are successful contributing members of the city of Portland. We pay taxes, we volunteer, we vote, we share our heritage, and we care about the collective future of our children and this community. We are well over 20 Native organizations in the area, and they're run and staffed by Native people. And our combined resources represent over $50 million in revenue that goes to local taxes, businesses, and services. Our population is young, and 24% of our, over 40% of our population is under the age of 25. I mean, that's a very staggering statistic. And that's why education and housing and things like that are so important to us. But our most important work revolves around preparing our youth to become the future leaders of this city and of their tribes and of our community. We are passing on many strengths and assets. We serve the community and we help each other. As distinct as urban tribal peoples may be, we have a collective vision of what we want for our children and families. We work to connect with other urban native people to create a common place to meet and to reconnect with each other, to do our ceremonies and cultures. We want to be recognized and treated with respect. We want our cultures and our religion to be valued. We want safe, affordable housing, access to employment options, and equal opportunities to build community. We have important and diverse indigenous values that worldviews that contribute to the livability and uniqueness of Portland, and we see ourselves as part of its future. Before we talk about NEA, I want to tell you a little bit about the Native American citizenship. I guess I read that. We're going on to the next part. Sorry. In the NEA Center, we served over 2,000 youths last year, and we served 600 families. In 2008 and 2009, we helped 40 people buy homes. And that is really important to us because a lot of us never made enough money or wouldn't have been able to buy a home. That's one of the important things. We provided housing, rent assistance, and financial wellness to hundreds of people. The last thing I want to share today is some of the outcomes that really make us proud and give us hope for the future. We had 11 youth graduate from the academy, 45 graduates from other schools, 30 kids finish college and other degrees. And we have elders in our building for exercise, lunch, and volunteerism, our best volunteers. One other thing, we helped over 300 people to find jobs in 2008 and 2009. But you know, this is all words, stuff on paper, you know, and it doesn't really mean anything until somebody who's lived through it will tell you about it. And for that, I'd like to turn the mic over to Cerise Palmentier.
My name is Cerise Palmentier. My given name is Subodi. I'm both Yakima and Colville, and I am one of my mother's 8 children, 6 girls, 2 boys. I'm also one of the 38,000 Native people living in the city of Portland. In addition to this membership, I'm part of the group of young Native people under the age of 25 who make up 50% of that population, and I am a NEA community member. I think it was in the 6th grade when I first became involved with NEA. And it wasn't necessarily by choice. I was skipping school a lot, and it didn't go unnoticed. Almost every day, there was somebody from NEA chasing me down the street, trying to load me into their car and take me back to school. Most often, that was Nora Farwell, and she's made a huge impact in my life, even though most days while she drove me to school, I sat there and I moped around and I looked sullen and defeated. At that time, I didn't understand that what she was doing was actually helping me. Then in my transition to high school, my family started moving around a lot, much like a lot of Native American families in Portland, because of the need to find affordable housing. And that really impacted my high school career. And I think it was my sophomore year when I counted how many times I had switched schools. And this was just that year, and it was 11 times that I had switched schools from moving around. And it really made my transcript, my high school transcript, look a little bit funny to counselors. And so my senior year of school, there was a counselor who called me to the front office, the guidance counselor, and she told me that she didn't know what I was doing there because I had nowhere near enough credits to graduate. And really, I only had enough credits to be a sophomore. And then she said that my best option would be to drop out of school and to go into trade school. And she gave me some pamphlets, probably thinking she was being helpful. That's when I asked her for a copy of my transcript. And I went back to NEA, and I talked to two of my tutors, my mentors, my guides through high school, who had tracked my whole career, and they were entirely confused by it. I showed them my transcript, and they counted up my credits, credit by credit, and it turned out that I had more than enough credits to graduate. Just the names for the classes were different than that school had, and they didn't take the time to check. That was when I went into the NEA Family Center to give them my transcript. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning, and they looked it over, and we figured out what was going on, and they called that counselor. And by 1 o'clock that afternoon, we were in her office, and quite diplomatically and professionally, they pounced on her. And by 3 o'clock that day, I was readmitted to school, and I was well on my way to graduation. When I graduated, I moved on to the Evergreen State College. I just graduated on June 12th, which was actually the same day that NEA had their graduation for their high school seniors at the academy. And it was both a beautiful and slightly disappointing day because my little sister graduated from the NEA Academy, and we weren't able to be there for each other. But we made a pact, and we took pictures of every little thing. And this weekend, we started putting together photo albums for each other of our graduations. And it was beautiful to see in our photo albums on opposite pages a picture of her in her graduating cap and gown with her NEA honor cord, and a picture of me in my cap and gown with my NEA honor cord. After graduating, I came back to NEA. I've always come back to NEA. No matter how many times I switched schools, I always came back to NEA. And it was for two reasons: for the people and for the programming. The staff there have always looked out for me, always made sure that I was on the right track and doing the things that I needed to be doing. And they made it fun with the programming. Going on field trips, learning about my culture and traditions, and they just rolled it all up into one little ball and handed it to me. Currently, I'm working with a program called Ninth Grade Counts, and I'm working with eighth grade students moving to the ninth grade, helping them make that transition smooth. And it means a lot because that transition was anything but smooth for me. And it means a lot to be able to come back to my community and help those younger than me.
Well said.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you, Commissioner, for inviting us to come and give this presentation, and thank the rest of the commissioners and Mayor Adams for having us here today. Usually when I'm here to visit, I'm usually advocating for something or asking for something, and today we're just here to share and celebrate. It's really been a truly wonderful year for our community, and I think in my 8 years at NAIA Family Center as the executive director, I just feel so privileged to be part of this community and to see us as such a united community with such phenomenal elders and mentors teaching folks like myself how to lead and such amazing future leaders. I'm really honored by Cerise's words today, and I met her when I first started at NAIA as well, so it's so wonderful to see her. I just wanted to share quickly a little bit about our organization, and I won't take too much of your time, but NAIA Family Center is so pleased to have grown and expanded to be able to truly serve the community in the way that our elders have always dreamed. While we're a 35-year-old organization, we really come into our own recently. And so often, as nonprofit organizations, I think it's really important that we talk about some of the benefits that we bring to the community. And I think that really talking about some of the benefits and resources that NAIA brings to this community is important as well. As you know, we are a nonprofit. We are not a tribe. We are not a sovereign nation. And we don't receive any special or specific resources because of our status as an Indian-owned and ran organization. Less than a quarter of 1% of our budget comes from tribal support, and so we're quite independent in that way. We currently have over 100 employees. Of those 100 employees, 87% are Native American, 96% are from underrepresented populations in the community, 96% also have a college degree, and of those, 40% have a master's degree or above. Of the 100 employees that we have an average salary of $47,000 with full benefits. And so I just think that's important to talk about, that we bring so many good jobs to this community, and we bring so many amazingly qualified Native professionals that contribute to the livability of this community. While we have an annual budget of about $7 million a year, less than 7% of our budget actually comes from the city of Portland. 80% of our budget actually comes from sources other than the city of Portland, the state of Oregon, and Multnomah County. And so we contribute quite a bit to this community in that way. Although I think it's really important to note that the resources and services that we do receive in partnership with the city of Portland are really critical to who we are, because it really creates the backbone of our organizational infrastructure and really allows us to go out and bring in additional partners. Since 2003, we have competed and brought in over $4 million in Department of Education competitive grants to this community so that we could provide services in four different school districts and serve hundreds and hundreds of children. Because of those services, we've been able to significantly increase the graduation rate. Now, we're really proud of these numbers, but there's also some challenges. In 2004, only 24% of Native students were graduating over 4 years. Last year, we had 37% of our students graduate over 4 years. So we're very happy about that increase, but it is still way too low and not acceptable to our community, and it shouldn't be acceptable to anyone. In the last 4 years, we've brought in an additional $5 million from foundations outside of the state of Oregon, and an additional $3.5 million from the Department of Health and Human Services from competitive grants. Today, we're not here to ask you for anything except for to tell you a little bit about how proud we are of our community, our diversity, and the gifts that we are able to provide this community, but also just to remind you that we need you to be our advocates. While we have a lot of positive things happening for us, as Ms. Grandma Lois shared, we still have the greatest level of poverty, and we have so many challenges when it comes to education and housing. You're in your elected roles have such value to our community, and it still happens to this day when Native Americans are left out of conversations, we're not included, or we're considered an insignificant population. And so we still need you to be the voice and to remind people that we are here. We want to be part of the discussion, and we really believe that we can be part of the solution. We have innovative ideas, we have a different way of looking at the world, and we, I think, have proven that we are committed to results and change. We also want you to help us in our effort to have Portland be very proud of its Native heritage. We have a huge Native population. We have so much to be proud of. We want our parks to be proud of Native heritage. We want our Planning Bureau to include Native voices and Indigenous worldviews in the way that they plan for this city. We want to be part of the sustainability movement. We want to make sure that when we're implementing green jobs and employment opportunities, that those opportunities reach our population.